Welcome to Mindful Social, the show that intersects mindfulness and emotional intelligence with the hectic online world we live in today. This week's guest is Gina Cox. She's an organizational psychologist, executive coach, and speaker, and her new book, Leading Inclusion, is an excellent guide for leaders who want to do more than just check the DEI box, but want to bring human-centric leadership forward. Her motto, Inclusion Tops Diversity, says a lot for her approach to creating better connection through respect and understanding for all players. Have a listen. Welcome, Gina, to Mindful Social. I'm so glad that you could be on today.
Oh, it's really a pleasure. Having listened to some episodes of your podcast and so on, I happen to know that you are a very gentle and gracious host. And so I'm in great hands. It's a pleasure.
Oh man, you just set the bar, didn't you? Thank you. Well, I'm anxious to dive in because there's so much in the book. And, you know, you did a huge amount of research, and a lot of the research, it goes back into the history of bias and racism and talking to CEOs about what was this really like for you. You know, I think after the last few years, I think there is finally a little more awareness of the necessity for caring about other people. And for me, I take DEI kind of from that, are we really treating other people like people?
Right.
Kind of approach. And it isn't about specific groups, it's about all of us. And I think that you hit that really well in the book. And, you know, I mean, I've done some DEI training and more coaching than anything else.
Yeah.
And it was really about seeing companies say, hey, we need a diversity and inclusion initiative, or they make it DEIB, or they come up with some acronym, whatever it is they think they need to have.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hire it out to a company that gives them a box. Or they, one of the things that I really like that you brought out in the book from your discussions with the leadership is they don't think about their company at all. It's a check the box thing. And then they can go home. And that's right. Bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to hear more about that. How do we start to uncover what's going on so that we can deal with it?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question and for checking out the book. I sort of wrote the cardinal rule for every nonfiction book author, which is I put tons of stuff in this one book and held nothing back. And my editors would probably say, you know, you could have written two books. And I say, well, life is too short. I might not get the chance. So there is a lot in that book. And the other reason there's a lot in that book, though, is because I'm an organizational psychologist by training. And it is really important. It was really important for me in writing this book that when I made assertions, or even when I talked about my experiences, which are equally valid, even though they would be based on an N of one, that people would know what the origin of that assertion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot in there. But, you know, like you, when I think about this subject matter that people call diversity, equity, and inclusion, I actually say, and I'm sure I said it somewhere in this book, there really is no such thing as diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's only, you know, effective leadership and healthy work cultures, because I primarily focus on the workplace, but this applies, of course, in any situation. And because I come at this from that lens, what I'm always focused on when I talk to leaders is just helping them to understand that employees in the companies that they manage with great pride can have a wide variety of experiences that often hinge upon the behavior of immediate managers, and also that sort of the rules of what does it feel like to work here. And if they think about that, once I get to talking with them about that, and they're very clear that I'm not talking about diversity as the primary focus, I'm talking about inclusion and respect as a primary focus, I think it gets a little easier for leaders to start thinking about why this matters and what they can do. So you heard me mention that I talk a lot about inclusion, and the book is called Leading Inclusion. And that's because after, especially it became obvious to me in the last 3 years that many leaders were guided probably by the kinds of people that you talked about who sold them a box as a solution. They were really focused on two things. They were focused on hiring more people in certain groups. Nothing wrong with that, but that was a primary focus. And then the second thing was implicit bias training. And then as time went on, people started to recognize that neither of those actions was being particularly successful. And in fact, here we are 3 years since the murder of George Floyd. Some people might even argue that in some ways we've gone backward. And why is that? And I'm getting to the specific answer to your question. It's because neither of those two solutions in a box could ever have delivered any kind of sustainable change. Instead, I say inclusion, you know, tops diversity. Mm-hmm. And what I try to get leaders to focus on is building a culture that's healthy enough that anybody could come into that culture and thrive. And I say focus on respect as the primary outcome that they set up, require, and measure. So that's a very high level, you know, sort of summary of my point of view on this kind of work.
Yeah, I like that. I also, you talk about the READY model,
yes,
which is respect, equity, diversity, and inclusion. And I love that it starts with respect. Mm-hmm. And I think many times in the book and in kind of my extrapolation of it, it's really about respect between individuals. And, you know, as I said before the show, for me, DEI is about respecting each other, caring about each other, seeing people who are being disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who they are.
Right.
And you also brought out in the book that talking to all of these leaders, CEOs, they really are not in touch with their people. And that's mm-hmm. kind of the root of the whole problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they're kind of in their ivory tower.
They're in their ivory tower, and often they're in their ivory tower through no fault of their own. I don't know a CEO who says, I want to be, well, maybe there are some, but I don't think a majority of the CEOs say, I want to be in an ivory tower where I am so distanced from the average employee's experience that I don't know what's going on. What I say in the book is that this often happens because they're, you know, a CEO has to depend on a group of people, he or she, to get them the critical information. And that often tends to be that C-suite and one level down, and sometimes external advisors. And there are some norms, for example, like don't tell the leader things they don't want to hear. Or, mm-hmm. you know, there can be an elephant in the room that no one wants to discuss because maybe in their part of the business, they're not doing such a good job with that issue. So they don't want to be the ones that bring it up. And then one other thing that gets in the way a lot of the CEO learning what's going on is that sometimes there are people who just don't believe in this kind of stuff that we're talking about today, Janet. And so they kind of slow walk everything. They don't put any real sustained effort into it. They're kind of hoping it all goes away. So leaders do sometimes, CEOs do sometimes find themselves in these situations where things happen that are truly revelations. They hadn't understood the issue before. And I think the stuff we're talking about is one of those issues. Mm-hmm. So things have gotten better, but it is important, I think, you know, I come from a background of measuring employee experience and opinions and using data to advise the C-suite. So probably that's the reason I'm very much inclined to say it's really important to understand employee opinions writ large. And if you're using surveys and focus groups, or if in addition to that, you're doing the best thing, which is making sure your managers are talking to the people in their teams, will know. But it doesn't always happen.
It doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you laugh when I said that because you know, like I know that this is not rocket science, right? The piece about the employee experience is not rocket science, but a lot of leaders either choose not to, or haven't been trained to, or feel like, especially nowadays, like they don't have the time to really get to know the people they lead. So they don't always deliver the respect, which I say is the key outcome. So let me talk about the respect outcome and why I say put respect first. And yeah, you I hope you laughed when you saw that I had an acronym. It was REDI. Because even when I wrote that, I laughed at myself. I figured by law, if you're writing a book, you got to have a framework, you got to have an acronym. So here you go. You're going to get an acronym, right?
Have to be followed.
It's a rule. But But also, I know that DE&I, those individual words are familiar to people. So I didn't want to just throw them out, throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I retained them just for the sake of communication, but I put the R in front. So my acronym is REDI, Respect, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. And really it reinforces the point that you put respect first. And the reason that I am so focused on this respect thing, I mean, we've all been taught to be respectful and that it matters and so on. But when I was researching the book for the book and I interviewed about 35 working Americans, and then I surveyed about 500 working Americans, 496, what I discovered is that one of the questions that I asked, what would you like your leaders to know about your experience in their organization, in your organization when it comes to inclusion? When I content analyzed the responses to those questions, there was a lot of stuff in there that sounded like respect or disrespect, as if that was the main thing employees were asking for. It was a bit of an epiphany that it would be so present. But the other thing I noticed is that, especially for employees of color who responded to the survey, their idea about respect was not just that interpersonal nicety part. That was like a par for the expected. I mean, we want
It
that
should be.
interpersonal thing, right?
Yeah.
But they were also focused on bigger ideas that I call feeling seen, heard, and valued, as my definition. Because what they were really saying in their comments was, we hold our leaders accountable or responsible for delivering a certain experience for us at work. We know they're capable of it, they deliver it to some people, but we want more. We don't want something different and special, we just want the same. So respect is at the core and should come first.
Yeah, it absolutely should be. And it should be no matter what. I mean, we just, the lack of respect, the lack of noticing and actually seeing people for who they are. And it's so much harder now with hybrid situations, work from home situations, where people are literally sidelined. And that's something that I think is really challenging. As you know, we are seeing companies coming back into the office, but even then, it's different. The timing's different. The community is fractured.
Yeah, and so the pandemic was definitely a point, an experience, a shared experience that let us know how vulnerable humans are, not just from a physical perspective, physical health perspective, but also from a psychological health perspective. Because what I am seeing that relates to this in our general experience, I'm seeing things like people going to concerts and throwing cameras and drinks on the performers on stage. I saw a pilot from Delta Airlines recently had to put out has a little script that he reads before his flights take off, telling people how they should behave on a flight because they were having so much abuse of flight attendants and people l watching videos without headphones and things like that. And so in the so what's happening is that it appears that we humans have kind of forgotten the value of respect. We might not even remember or know the definition of it. And we definitely don't seem to be able to tell when we're manifesting it and when we're not. And in the workplace, that's what I'm seeing.
And definitely not just in the workplace, it's everywhere. It's shocking.
It is.
And it's very, I think it's indicative of the trauma that we've been through in the last years and not knowing what to do with that.
I agree with you, Janet. And I like the way you put that because I have a habit which was built into me. It's not something that I learned. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. Now, I'm not a pushover. I'm not naive. I also call out the difficult issues and all of that. But I give people the benefit of the doubt on this because I see the changes, but I don't think some of the people who are manifesting these behaviors are seeing the difference, the change, the before and the after, right? I clearly see these behaviors that were not commonplace before. And many of us see it, not just me. And I think about it a lot because somebody was telling me a story just today about this woman went with her child to, I don't know. Let's say it was a tent where you go to get a Christmas tree, or there's something related to the holiday season involved. But it was a physical space where it was an entry point, and this woman was standing there with her child, and this other person came up and kind of started to barrel past them, and the mom turned and said, "Oh, you know, we were next in line. It's our turn." And the person just let loose a barrage of, you know, foul language. Well, you know, sort of like in the before times, I mean, they're individuals. I mean, that could just be a rude individual, a sick individual, all of that in general. However, when I heard that story, it did remind me of the frequency with which I'm seeing these kinds of behaviors, where you would say, well, a reasonable person would say, well, you know, oh, I will notice that there's somebody else there. Mm-hmm. A reasonable person might say, oh, they've got a child, so maybe, you know, whatever, it's not that big of a deal, let them go ahead of me. And furthermore, that a reasonable person might say, I'm not going to speak like this in front of a child, like just even not knowing yeah. anything. Those would be sort of like the human, I would expect, aspects of that interaction. But I think that's exactly what you and I are agreeing upon, is that something seems to have gotten lost in that humanity, seeing you, experiencing you in the same space that I'm in experience. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
I have a theory on that, but it's really that we had so much empathy for all of the trauma that we've seen over the last few years that we put barriers up as kind of a self-protective mm-hmm. way. And maybe I'm not saying we in the right way, because I don't think you do, and I don't yeah. either,
yes.
but
yes.
somebody yeah. is really struggling so hard that they're just angry all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that societally in every aspect. And it's Absolutely. Really not going to be something that we can dissolve mm-hmm. easily.
Yeah.
And even with, you know, I belong to a lot of organizations around compassion and how can we share this more and how can we help people to understand that we're all in this together. And yeah. yet we've all become so isolated mm-hmm. and we've all kind of put our blinders on and wanted to stay away. And I think mm-hmm. that when I was reading in the book about how the sea level is kind of separate. And yeah, there are plenty of good reasons for that. But as human beings, we need to take that extra step to go, okay, I need to go walk the floor
yeah.
and find out who's out there and what their issues are. And not in a focus group and not right. in a survey.
That's right.
And not in bias tests, because we're all biased.
Yes,
we are
exactly.
all biased.
That's right. That's right.
There's no way around it.
That's
but
right.
it's when we see those biases, what do we do with it?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Frankly, I've had a PhD since 1996. And if there's one thing I have learned from reading extensively, doing research and all of the things that I've done in those decades, it is that the most important thing I could teach or share with people is that the fundamentals of management haven't changed.
Mm.
And if you'd never read another book, if you never hired another coach, if you never did anything else, if you remember the dyad, you and the person you're leading, if you just remember the dyad every time, and if you are leading two people, and if you're leading 250,000, you can't know everyone is the 250,000. But if you focus on the dyad and you say to everyone who has responsibility for leading people, because the cells get smaller and smaller as they go out.
Right.
I have my 10 people. I need to know each one of those 10. I don't have to see them every day. We don't have to work in the same physical space. Mm-hmm. I need to be curious about Gina so I can build a connection with Gina. The connection is going to enable me to create the circumstances whereby we can have comfort in that relationship.
Mm.
That applies to neighbors too. You know, this curiosity, comfort, connection, comfort thing, because we all want comfort. So managers at any level, you know, it is important to reinforce these fundamentals, which I refuse to call soft skills because they are apparently the hardest things that we can do as humans. I never call them soft.
I agree.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the story you tell in the book about your neighbor and you put the sign out in your yard and the neighbor was like, "What sign?" kind of illustrates how obtuse we can be.
Yes. Yes. And in that case, in that particular story, it might be just as well that we can be so obtuse in a way, because I'll just quickly mention the story where I had put up this flag, you know, my hippy dippy trippy flag. I have more than one of them. When they get rusty and old, I put a new one up because they mean a lot to me, right? And my neighbor had this other flag that I didn't quite understand that was symbolic of things that for that had a negative connotation for me. And so I made a decision that I would try to understand what my neighbor's flag was about. So I got the opportunity to go ask the neighbor. And the neighbor's explanation made complete sense to me. And not only did it make complete sense to me, I decided to accept it on face value, even though I knew there were certainly some negative connotations that could be applied. But that's not what my neighbor told me. And so we had this wonderful connection. And I said, you know, I was a little hesitant to come because I didn't know if you'd see my flag and if my flag might have offended you in some way or made you feel distant from me in some way because there were such different ideas. And my neighbor said, what flag? I didn't see your flag. And that actually goes to the point you were making. We're sort of going through life. We're not even noticing the things that are happening around us. We're not noticing things. We're not noticing people. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, it was okay because we had a conversation. And ever since then, when we see each other, if I'm outside doing yard work or whatever, we wave. And that is all it takes to create a connection.
Yes. That's all. That connection, and you mentioned dyads earlier, and you know, when I teach, we always start class with dyads,
yeah,
where people actually open their hearts to someone else.
Wow.
Which is very scary.
Yes.
Many people, but it's always amazing because the most amazing things come out of people's mouths that they tell total strangers, and it's the anonymity kind of. Even if they're working on the same team, they never knew that this was like that and this was like that. And
That's right.
My gosh. And you always find something that brings people together.
So they
can wave the next time they see that person, even if they disagree. And we need a lot more of that in this country.
Oh, I know. I did a little social experiment in the fall of 2020. This is 2023. So it would have been fall of 2021. You know, near my house, there's a path where I ride my bike or go for walks. And I noticed, you know, there's just a bunch of people that never took their eyes up off the road. They never said good morning. They never said good morning. It was mostly morning. They just went by as if there was not another human present, right? And they didn't do it to me, to Gina. They were just doing, that was their MO. And so I did this little experiment where I just, I'm going to disrupt this. I'm going to say, good morning. Good morning. Even when I can see from the body language, or even though I know from history, from experiencing this person, that they aren't really looking for this, I'm still going to try it. And guess what? So I would say, hello. Some people would be startled. Some people would look at frown. Some people would do whatever, but in the end, I did this for about 3 weeks, just for fun. A majority of the people smiled, acknowledged me in some way, and there were a few that started initiating the hi next time around. Mm-hmm. Now, that's all anecdotal, but I'm not, you know, giving it more credence than it's worth, other than to make a point that I think each of us can disrupt those patterns. You know, when we lead organizations, there's a bigger burden on us because we have to disrupt a pattern for a whole company, and we ought to if it doesn't exist. But for most of us, we can do this, as you say, in our classrooms, at church, in the grocery store, when we sit next to somebody on a plane or for a flight. And, you know, there are a lot of little opportunities that we have to just see the other human and interact with them for two seconds.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I really thought was interesting about the book is that you get some really good tips on, okay, how are you going to reach out more? How are you going to kind of put your heart out there, be a little vulnerable and do that in a way that, you know, isn't going to make you feel too icky, but you know, we kind of have to put our toe in the water at the very least. We can't just say, oh, well, that's somebody else's problem. It's not my problem. And I don't care what level of the company you're at. It's our problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Two of the people that I interviewed for my book, I interviewed like 30 people for the book, specific experts, included among those were Alyssa Cohn and Dori Clark. Now, Dori Clark is somebody whose work I followed for about 12 years or so at this point. And I consider her to be an unofficial mentor. because when I first started to read her work, there was so much about her that her work that resonated with me. The main idea at the time when I first met her or started reading her books was this notion that you can create your own reality in terms of your career, the things that you want. And she would share tips about that. Now, all these years later, her latest book is called The Long Game. And that book resonated even more because the point that she makes in that book is that for most of the things that we want, you know, it's not going to come overnight. There's a process. We have a plan and we take step one and step two, and we go iteratively down the path. But I interviewed her. Part of what we discussed in the interview was connection, you know, and she believes strongly that, you know, it's really important to meet people, to keep meeting more people, to broaden your perspective, to develop your ability to communicate with other humans. And so that's in the book. Alyssa Cohn is even more specific, because Alyssa she shares in my book and in her own work, she talks about how one must be purposeful about making connections. Mm-hmm. And so practice, you know, like going to an event and trying, going to a situation where you could go in and never talk to someone, a baseball game, you know, you could get away with never talking. Practice just saying hello to someone, finding something you have in common, saying, oh, Janet, those are some cool eyeglasses. Where'd you get those? Whatever, find the thing that can start mm-hmm. the conversation. And then, and this is something leaders can do. At least the idea of it is, I once coached an executive in financial services company who had to ride an elevator up to, I don't know, 50 floors or whatever. When he got into the elevator in the mornings, he turned his body to look into the corner because he didn't really want to interact with everybody else who was getting onto the elevator. He literally did that. He had to learn how to be human, because he was only focusing on the fact that they were making big deals and generating a lot of money. And he thought that that was effective leadership. But another tip in the book had to do with the fact that two things that Chris Shembra talks a lot about, which are, you know, practicing gratitude and using social like meals as an opportunity to bring people together. So for leaders, I mean, you know, especially if you're doing virtual and remote, you can't physically always bring everybody into the office, but you could even do that virtually. You could do things virtually we're not talking about the work. We're not talking about problems. We're not talking about process. We're talking about one another. We're connecting, you know, and we don't do enough of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say, Dori Clark's been on the show and I admire her greatly. She's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And secondly, yes, I take a lead from my sister. I'm actually an introvert, very introverted. But I'm getting better because my sister is one of those people that if you go somewhere to a bus stop, by the time the bus gets there, she will know everybody's history.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful talent that I've been trying to cultivate, because it really does. It takes people off guard and then it allows them to open to that.
That's right. And they relax. I call it comfort. You know, the ultimate outcome is comfort, ease, another word that I use. I think that's what comfort and ease convey. You're just going through and there are not all of these awkward nubs and things sticking out, getting in the way. Yes. Comfort and ease convey you're just living. And I think, and you got the hard times like everybody does, and you have the good times, but there isn't this additional burden of these interpersonal knots and crannies, nooks and crannies. And I think that's what we all desire. Mm-hmm. I'm an introvert too. Like you. And so this is definitely something that I have learned to do. I you know, when I go to, when not so much, they don't have a lot of these anymore, but a company event where there was, you know, at the end of the day, a social, you know, I practice over the years how I would be, you know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be first. I would come into the room when X number of people in a room that I would imagine, you know, and then I would go directly to the bar and get myself a Sprite, into which I would say, sometimes I would get ginger ale. Okay, so now put it in a rocks glass and put a piece of lemon on there, because I don't like to drink when I'm working, but I know that if I don't look like I fit in with this drink, that's going to make my life hard. I had a whole routine with that. So I'd have my drink and then I would look before I left that bar, I was holding on. It was kind of like I'd be holding on to the bar for dear life, but not really. But I'd look around to see which of these groups looks like they have some body language where I might be able to just go up to the fore. And I went through that whole process. Where is your sister? And people like her, they just go wherever. And I'm like, huh? So the people who have that naturally, I think they're fantastic. The rest of us, we can work on it.
Yeah, we can work on it, and we really can. And yeah, I've been there many times where I'm just like, can I leave now? You know, it's so interesting because really it comes back down to the R, to respect.
Yes.
When you reach out to somebody that you don't know and you're actually making yourself vulnerable and you show that vulnerability, they're going to share something with you.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Now we've got that human connection. And now we can think of each other in a totally different way because, you know, one of my favorite lecture stories is about when you're sitting in the office and you see that guy coming towards you and you just know that there's going to be some stupid conversation that you don't want to deal with. And you're setting yourself up for this rash of negativity.
Yeah.
And how is he going to respond to that? He's going to respond negatively too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But if you can turn your mind to, I saw him do something nice once, and flip the switch on how you think about that person, just open up for a minute and think maybe they kissed a puppy sometime. It can change your approach to them. It changes their approach to you. And now we can meet on a level playing field. And have a conversation and see each other as humans. And that's just so important because we can't understand somebody else's struggle unless we talk to them.
That's absolutely right. And it's really funny. I'll tell you about the most recent example where I created the situation. And because I do work on this, I work on this for personal reasons that I already related, which is I'm an introvert and I have had to learn to work on this. The other reason I work on it though, is because I'm on a sort of like a professional level. I believe in this stuff. I completely believe in it. And so because I believe in it, I practice it. And so I went to Costco recently. Most people might not even know this, but in my particular Costco, there's an ophthalmologist. She's very, very good. And I've been going to her for years. And then of course I can just buy my contact lenses and my eyeglasses in the same building. I love efficiency, but the physical characteristic of that space is not a huge space. Like if you went into a standalone store. So I remember I went up to the entrance to this place and I saw a cart and it had like a giant rack of beef sitting in this cart. I was like, well, that's interesting. My brain processed this. I noticed the beef and I was like, okay, well, I assume, oh, there must be somebody in there getting their eyes examined. And for whatever reason, they got the beef before they went and got the exam. Whereas maybe I had a little laugh about this to myself, whereas I would have probably waited till after because, you know, it's going to just sit there. So I go into the place and there's a guy sitting there and I check in and then I go sit down and the lady who checked me in said, oh, something, something, Gina, call me by my first name. So the guy spins around and he goes, oh, that's my wife's name. And from there, it all went downhill where we had the most amazing conversation, starting with just the acknowledgement of this name. And then I said, is that your beef out there? And he goes, yeah. I go, well, when I pulled up with my car, it just seemed like such an intimate experience that it made me laugh. And so we talked about, my point is, this guy was a complete stranger, but then he told me he had just had heart surgery. He told me about the incision is still healing. He told me that I probably don't need to be eating that beef. And we went through a whole bunch of things to your point. He told me so much about himself in that time that I was sitting there waiting for my exam. And then his wife came out.
Oh.
And her name is Gina. He hadn't said that, but the reason he had flipped around was because Gina. And so then she got involved in the conversation. And I remember thinking just that 15 minutes of time flew by and I felt like I was talking to an old friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept that warm, fuzzy feeling for the rest. I don't know when it dissipated or if it ever dissipated. It's mm-hmm. there. I remember it vividly. It's that powerful.
That is powerful.
Yeah, very, very powerful.
We need more of those. We need a
and
lot
let me just say, these were to white people, and I'm saying this on purpose because I am not somebody who spends my life obsessing about race, but I'm going to say this on purpose because this is audio. I'm going to say that I'm a Black woman to those who haven't seen me, and that these were two white women. And one of the things that I observed in that interaction, or one of the things I felt in that interaction, is we don't have enough of those conversations, right? Mm. Because we in our country are so separated by a variety of things. And sometimes it's almost automatic that we kind of squeeze our shoulders in and just kind of look at one another out of the corners of our eyes, you know, in a very sort of English looking over the newspaper kind of way, but we don't have to. We don't have to do that. We can just talk.
Yeah, we do. And it's so important that we do. And I think, you know, the actions that you have in the book, there's some really good things there for people to read, and, you know, to also to read the history part and get some context into what's going on around here. Because, you know, I had to laugh when you said in the book that your company gave everybody Juneteenth off to go out and learn about Black history.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Yeah, no, that was a weird time. And again, that place when I was where I was working at the time is a great organization. Mm. And I know that it was hard sometimes to tell these stories because you think that people think you're trying to criticize something bigger than what you're criticizing or what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But the whole point of that situation about Juneteenth of 2020, I'll never forget, because I knew all about Juneteenth and I didn't know the whole America didn't.
Right.
I didn't grow up in the United States, but when I came to the United States at about age 20, I celebrated my 21st birthday in the United States. I learned from then on till now, I learned something new every day. And one of the things I had somewhere along the line learned about was Juneteenth. I had even been to some Juneteenth festivities. I never noticed that only certain people, I didn't know that only certain people knew about it. So on Juneteenth of 2020, when this became a national story and employers didn't know what to do and so on, the company where I was at, they made the decision they would give that day as a holiday for everyone. And it was actually a good decision in the sense that it was the one little thing the CEO felt he could do in a moment of absolute, where the country was at one of the lowest points that it has ever been in, from my personal experience living here. And that was the day right after George Floyd had been killed, where I don't care who you are, at the human level, the waves change. You could feel it in the air. Something was different. And a lot of the something that was different was something for good, right? Something for good, as you said at the beginning of the show. So this was that moment. And the CEO didn't know what to do. And they made this decision at the very least to probably help people just release some of the tension, think for a moment, mm-hmm. even if it was just to say, I have this day off, I don't know what I'm going to do, but just maybe to have 5 minutes to think. And so in that sense, it was good. Although it revealed that larger problem, of course, that we were so separated that we didn't know. When I got back to work that following week, it was a bit of it didn't go so well in that sense, because I think people shared a lot of experiences about things that they had learned for the first time that I was gobsmacked. But again, this was my learning, mm-hmm. you know, how people didn't know these things. I just assumed everybody studied these things in school, let's say.
Yeah.
So
we
you know,
do that though, don't we?
We
assume that everybody knows what we know.
Yeah.
And then
it was
we
a learning.
Ask questions.
It was a learning for me. So ultimately, you know, the answer to your question is ultimately for me, that whole thing was a learning experience. The only thing I hoped is that it would be a learning experience for everybody. You know, I hope so. I still hope so. I still think so. You know, people are talking about things they never used to talk about before.
That's true. That's true. Although I do have to say that my Black friends are all like, okay, could you just not ask me? Does it have to be me every time? But that's a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, that is another interesting thing. I think, you know, you would ask, okay. So here's like a good stereotypical response to this. I have Jewish friends and I definitely ask my Jewish friends about Jewish holidays. I definitely ask them when they say they sat Seder, I'm like, what does that mean? I definitely ask them, the other day we were talking about, my friend said to me, she pointed me to a place where I felt like eating a bagel, and she told me So this is totally stereotypical, but she told me, you know, to go to this place, and it was really good. We had a good laugh about it. So I do that, and when people ask me questions about the Black experience or the Caribbean experience or the experience of being a mother or the experience of being an IO psychologist, I figure, yeah, I know a lot about these things. I don't mind. Or a woman. I don't mind. I don't mind. We laugh.
Yeah. I think for some, it was more because it was such a focused event that everybody was inundated with the same questions.
Yes.
And we have to be aware of that.
Yes. Oh, in that sense, absolutely. Because I think some people, and it is true, would say that you don't go to the people who are feeling the burden of a problem and ask them to solve it. And so from that perspective, right, I think some people saw it that way. And frankly, I did a video today. I call it a love letter to DE&I professionals, where I just said to them, I see you, I feel you. I thank you for all the work that you're doing under difficult circumstances. But, you know, historically, DE&I professionals have been people from minoritized groups and underrepresented groups, which is a whole other story, but it relates to this whole notion of, is that really the best way to get something solved if the people who are being asked to solve it are the ones that are already not included in the big circle and also are feeling the burden of whatever the thing is? I don't know the answer to that, but I do think we should have a variety of people involved in that work.
And it is a huge discussion, because when you start breaking things up and you're like, you know, I'm gay and I get questions all the time, and people are like, so how do we deal with this? You know, there's always something. And we just need to ask the questions and be mindful in how we ask the questions.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because the other thing I like to say to people is there are only 12 months in the calendar year in our system. And if we start splitting everybody up into all of their various identities, we have long since run out of months. So we can't have a month for every unique identity that a person possesses. And most people possess multiple significant identities. Mm-hmm. So identities do matter. And I'm not being Pollyanna about this. And, you know, clearly there's something about the Black experience. Clearly there's something about the immigrant experience. Clearly there's something about the LGBTQ+. I mean, all of that is real. But when you're thinking about this at the level of a system level of trying to make changes in an organization, I think that if you try to acknowledge every one of those identities in a certain kind of very specific way, it can be really problematic to getting something done.
Yes. Just listing all of the different segments of the population can take all day.
Yeah. It's kind of an irony. And when I say that, I know that it isn't always understood, because on the other hand, I turn around and say, I really do believe that the Black experience in this country is so unique that there's some that characteristics of that experience, including, of course, there are Black people who are gay and there are Black people who are disabled and they're Black, like all of that. I think that there's something unique about that. But if I were going to try to, when I try to solve this problem at a system level, what I'm really interested in solving for is this respect outcome, because it's like a cheat sheet. If I could get the respect thing focused on, it'll take care of all of the issues in these identity groups. I'm like, it's a magical elixir that, you know, I think of it that way in some ways.
Yeah, I think it is. Because I think that's, as you said earlier, you know, that's what people want. They just want respect.
That's what they want. And then
in their own definition of what that is.
Yeah. In the eye of the beholder, there's a lot of literature about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh, Gina, this was fun.
Oh, good. Good. I'm so glad.
Yeah, this has been a really great conversation. And I highly encourage people to get the book and to dig in, you know, and not necessarily feel like you have to read the whole thing, but find the titles of the chapters that resonate with you. And then you're going to go back because you're going to want to. So
yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. And if I have a little companion piece that I created, and if any about that focuses on respect, and if anyone is interested in that, it's a free ebook that they can get by going to the front page of my website, which is ginacox.com. And there's a little form they can fill out there and they can download that.
Cool. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I will share that link, the link to the book, links to all your social networks so that people can find you.
Okay.
And gosh, I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Oh, Janet, this has been great. You know, for the benefit of those of you who are listening, when one is a host, when one is a guest on a podcast, it is a big deal because that person who is running this podcast, in the case in Janet, and you know her well, you know that you know, it's like going into someone's home. And so I always consider it a high honor. And Janet, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very glad that we connected, and thank you.
Thanks for tuning in for another episode of Mindful Social. It's been so great to see the subscriptions growing, and the feedback has really helped me make the show even better. So if you know somebody who needs to be on the show, email me at janet@janetfouts.com, and please send me feedback there too, or post a review on the podcast platform you're listening on. Oh, and do me a favor, share this show on social media or with a friend. Thank you.